What's up, everybody? I'm back with another edition of the State of Bitcoin podcast, where I'm joined by Dylan LeClaire, the man, the myth, the legend. We talk all about macro, the overall state of the Bitcoin environment, and much, much more. So tune in for another action-packed episode. And as always, ladies and gentlemen, this is not financial advice. Please do not take it as financial advice. Be sure to hit that subscribe button as well. And shout out to my sponsors, The Bitcoin Advisor. You can set a meeting directly with me if you'd like to go to content.thebitcoinadvisor.com/greencandle. And we could have a chat on how I can help you get your Bitcoin off of an exchange with collaborative custody model. We are a partner with Unchained, so we can, you know, hold one key, Unchained holds a key, and you hold a key, so there's not a single point of failure. We can help with estate planning and much, much more. So be sure to reach out to me at content.thebitcoinadvisor.com/greencandle. And that's also in the show notes. And shout out to Hodler's Official. That's HODLERS. official.com. They have the number one jerseys in the game. They got basketball and baseball jerseys. You can get that those with promo code GREENCANDLE to get 10% off your entire order. All right, now let's get into the episode. Whoosh. Bing bong. I am back with another edition of the State of Bitcoin podcast, where I've got the man, the myth, the legend, Dylan LeClaire here in the house with me. And, you know, it's the second trading day as we're recording this of the Bitcoin ETF. So all the hubbub, right? We got the halving, we got potentially interest rates coming down this year, and the Bitcoin spot ETF all coming through. So, you know, Dylan, I know you're a big hype man. Orange Coin good. We were just talking about that a little bit pre-show, but how can you find a way not to be bullish on this year that we got coming up in 24 with all the things that I've said considered? Or are you, you know, an extreme bull and think, you know, full steam ahead?
Yeah, I mean, definitely bullish. It's, you know, a lot of the conversation over the last couple of days, a week, you know, following the ETF has been interesting. You know, all the Wall Street people and finance people are opining with, you know, what they believe to be interesting new takes, which are as the same recycled, either good takes or bad takes that we've seen for, you know, a decade. It's nothing new to the Bitcoiners. I really perceive it as like Wall Street bending the knee rather than the other way around. Wall Street's capitulating, Bitcoin's not capitulating to Wall Street. So, you know, many people are worried that they're going to play paper games and all this stuff. Same thing with gold. I'm really not worried about it. I think, you know, the transparency of the flows and all that are obviously is very clunky right now. It's pretty opaque. I think that improves, obviously, just given that Bitcoin's a superior asset in transparency wise relative to gold or other commodities or even stocks, you know. You know, you had the stuff where like GME was shorted 130% of its float a couple years ago. That's just not, I mean, it's not possible with Bitcoin, but with the ETF, if that happens, they're going to get their face ripped off. And I don't think that actually happens. So I think there's some, you know, GBTC outflows are maybe put a lid on the price for a little bit. Again, I'm really not interested in what happens tomorrow or the next week or even next month, really. Like, it's more so the message of the people that for the last decade have said Bitcoin's a scam. I mean, even like JV Diamond is still saying it, but, you know, Bitcoin's a scam. It's money laundering. It's useless. It's a Ponzi scheme, to now being like, okay, this is good enough. It's a monetary commodity. It's an international asset. It's a, you know, XYZ buzzword. Here, clients, put, add it to your portfolio. And, you know, there's an army of financial advisors that get a, you know, share of BlackRock iShares fees when they put clients into this sort of stuff. Not Bitcoin unique, but gold ETFs, S&P 500, tech, whatever, you know, ESG portfolios, energy, whatever it is. You know, iShares being BlackRock and other ETFs are similar. You know, there's a fee sharing revenue for putting clients in this stuff. So, I mean, it makes sense, right? Bitcoin's the best risk adjusted asset over most time frames over the last 10 years. I expect that to continue to be the case. And, you know, the marketing blitz from just the first couple of days of the ETF, whether it's more, you know, to the new gen of investors or very much to the boomer crowd, you know, like Grayscale's ETF commercial was super bland. I saw BlackRock put out one. I didn't even watch it, but I was expecting that. And the halving's like 100 days away, right? So, you know, we have this, what we perceive as a supply shock, which, you know, we can debate the merits of that or the stock to flow stuff. But really, I think it's going to be like this global marketing event of, and it has been for the last three halving events with Bitcoiners. Each halving, subsequent halving, is like an order of magnitude of a bigger, larger understanding globally, and also just a bigger deal. And this halving event, it's going to be like, look, in the face of the FOMC Fed rate cuts, of, you know, whatever the madness of the US political kind of election season, which is coming later down the pipe in 2024, Bitcoin, uninfluenced by anyone's, you know, desires or money or influence, is cutting its supply oceans by 50%. It's programmatic. You can't stop it. No one can do anything to change that. And that's, you know, for the boomer investor class with, you know, the trillions of assets, it's like this, wait, what just happened? You know, it's like, oh, the supply got cut in half. And no, supply didn't get cut in half. The issuance is cut in half. And the vast majority of people, like, we're very much stuck in our own echo chamber. The vast majority of people don't actually understand how this works, what's revolutionary about the tech. You know, it's like, oh, the blockchain thing, you know, the crypto asset that's a ticker on a screen, that's, you know, the speculative sort of bubble, like, and no one has really spent the time, not no one, but very few. I think we kind of forget this in our Bitcoin ecosystem echo chamber. Very few people have put in the time to deeply understand this at a technical level, at an economics level, you know, and oftentimes when confronted with this reality, people reject it because it takes a lot of, you know, you have to check your ego at the door and, you know, spend a lot of time relearning fundamental truths that you thought you knew, which were actually wrong, about money and about economics and about finance, to approach this thing, and actually understand it at a deep level. So I think, like, you know, what price does up, down, sideways on a shorter time frame, like, it's a fool's errand. And I've learned through my journey that price targets or time frames is kind of just a shit show crapshoot. It's just like, you know, but on a long time frame, it's like, yeah, we're going up because this is fixed supply. And, you know, many people don't understand this and are starting to, you know, there was conversations last week for the first time with people, you know, with big pocketed investors about what this thing is and why finally BlackRock and everyone else is, you know, knocking at the door. And so, like, is it priced in? Like, okay, in the first 24 hours, like, it's a pointless discussion, in my opinion. But it's obviously very exciting for all of us who have been, you know, banging the drum about the value prop for so long.
100%. And it seems like, you know, traditional finance, maybe even traditional finance media too, you know, I mean, obviously CNBC has been covering Bitcoin for some time, but they kind of lump it in with crypto. It seems like the you know, the hosts there are starting to understand Bitcoin a little bit, or at least trying to dip their toe in the water. And, you know, you, of course, have made some appearances on there. You know, we've had, you know, Anthony Pompliano, Marty Bent, Natalie Brunel, you know, the list goes on of influential Bitcoiners come on traditional mainstream media and describe a little bit, you know, in the 2-minute soundbite that you get about what Bitcoin is. And then now with this BlackRock coming in, BlackRock ETF and the, what is it, like 9 or 11 others that have come in, you know, I think it just adds legitimacy to what Bitcoiners have been seeing this entire time. But were you shocked at all about the influx of dollars coming in? Because, you know, it seems like it was the most bought, you know, spot ETF that's ever been launched. And, you know, it seems like, you know, there was just a lot of anticipation behind it, obviously from the Bitcoiners. But I'm personally a little shocked about the aim from traditional finance, just simply because it seems like since all of this time, they've been banging the drum on the other side of things, but now they're starting to flip the coin on it, or flip the script on Bitcoin and start to get into it. You know, why do you think that you know, the time is now, right before the halving. And, you know, with everything that has gone on the past, you know, 4 years, why do you think that the spot ETF has kind of, I guess, come to fruition here in 2024?
Yeah, I mean, I think after, you know, sort of disastrous 2022, from a perception standpoint, and just, you know, the infrastructure of crypto rails kind of just crumbled. And that's nothing new to Bitcoin. I mean, I was laughing because I wasn't around in the Mt. Gox era, of course. You know, I was in grade school. But, you know, FTX collapsed and people were like, well, this is it, guys. Pack it up. Go home. And I was laughing because it was like the only exchange in the world collapsed. And, you know, when Mt. Gox went down and Bitcoin survived. Right. So it's like this the second largest crypto bucket shop collapsed, a bunch with it, you know, along with all the lenders and market makers and whatever. And, you know, Bitcoin system was unchanged. It's just the exchange rate. So, that wasn't a shock to me. And obviously it was a great stacking opportunity, but, you know, once you saw all that happen and then you saw the BlackRock ETF, application, you look at their history, they've been, you know, their 500 wins, on approvals and, you know, one rejection. The one rejection was a non-transparent ETF that was actively traded, right? You know, kind of against the ethos of like an ETF and what it means. So I was like, okay, well, this thing's basically getting approved. And then you looked at the prior ETF denials, and it was basically saying like, look, offshore bucket shops like Binance are very opaque. There's manipulation there, and stablecoin fraud and manipulation. And you see CZ get stepped down, indicted. They, you know, get a backdoor into Binance's data room, you know, for like the feds at the US for like 3, 4, 5 years. And then, you know, Tether onboards the three-letter agencies. I forget what ones. It was, you know, CIA or Secret Service or a couple, I don't even know. It was like a couple, you know, the US three-letter agencies were like onboarded to Tether. And then you saw these chunks of $100 million kind of freezes of USDT tokens. And so like, it was like, okay, well, yeah. So they're now, you know, kind of given the green light here. Like Tether, I think the truthers, and of which I've occasionally been, you know, I've tweeted at Paolo and said, hey, what's the answer to this? What's the answer to that? You know, did Sam wire you $30 billion? Like what's this look like? Because for me, I'm always like a don't trust verify sort of guy. It's like, hey, Paolo, it'd be great to see the Q-steps of this debt, right? I'm not saying you don't have the debt. I'm just like, where is it, right? And when you see them onboard the feds, when you see Cantor Fitzgerald, you know, who was long rumored to have been the bank or the holder of treasuries for Tether, go on CNBC and give an endorsement live, you know, a multi-billion dollar financial institution kind of give a mark of approval for Tether. It's like, okay, well, the lines are being dotted across, like this thing is a go. So yeah, I mean, I think it's very much the past couple of years. Like, I don't think the whole crypto crash of 2022 was this like intentionally engineered thing. All financial markets that went down, bonds drew down 30, 40, 50%, right? You know, same with tech stocks and, you know, the S&P 500. Right. Like Bitcoin rallied in 2023, but it wasn't just Bitcoin. It was like literally all risk. Right. So obviously, you know, Bitcoin benefited. But my point is, after the whole wipeout of 2022, there was this kind of, I think, behind the scenes sort of U.S. this preparation for U.S. liquidity to really get, you know, onboarded to this asset in a big way. And whether you think that's good or bad, right, Bitcoin's obviously global. Right. But when you think about, you know, the financial asset landscape, the majority of the liquidity and, you know, market cap of global assets is in U.S. dollars and U.S. dollar denominated assets, U.S., you know, U.S. stocks, bonds. So the fact that, you know, the kind of the mark of approval is given, and, you know, behind the scenes, you see stuff like the CBOE being like, OK, we're going to, you know, launch our Bitcoin futures and options and, you know, maybe give Bitcoin denominated collateral as an option later on. Like all of this stuff is sort of like, okay, the US big boys want in, right? It's not like finally they're like, okay with Bitcoin. It's not like Larry Fink is this like huge Bitcoin bull. Larry Fink's whole business model is fees, right? So when his clients are like, look, we want Bitcoin fees. They're knocking on the door day after day, or that they want Bitcoin assets. Larry Fink will happily provide a vehicle to collect fees to do so. So I think that's what it is, right? It's just this U.S. market. It's kind of been this shadow thing for a while. Retail, kind of the far end of risk and speculative, you know, sort of like VC investors that have been interested in crypto. And now it's this recognition that, okay, this thing's not going away. We tried, you know, we tried to kill it for a while. It tried to kill itself for a while, and it keeps coming back. You can't, you know, it's this million-headed hydra. And okay, so if it's not going away, we should, you know, have an interest in owning this. And I think that it's not, there's not a consensus. There's not one guy. It's not like Larry Fink or, you know, whoever is pulling the string saying, okay, we now approve this. It's a horde of people saying like, look, we want Bitcoin and we don't want to go like that. I think the misconception a lot of people have is like you or I, Brandon, can go on Coinbase or River or Strike and boom, you know, log in, enter an email, create an account, add a debit card or a bank account, and wire money, buy Bitcoin in like 30 minutes, right? Or, you know, however long the onboarding takes, a day, right? If you're like a pension fund, or even like if you listen to what Saylor said about MicroStrategy, and he's the majority, he has the majority of the voting rights for the company. It took them months, right? This was, you have to figure out the legal handlings, you have to figure out the custodian, you have to figure out the accounting, you have to figure out all of this sort of stuff, right? And so it's a much more complicated it's a much more complicated process for these institutional investors. So, you know, GBTC was an option. It's not a great one. It's closed down. The discount wrecked a lot of people. Futures are, you know, CME, right? It's okay, but the contracts expire. You have to roll them. You have to be regulated to trade futures. It's just, but an ETF, I mean, everybody has access to an ETF. So it kind of like, obviously it's great to harness Bitcoin's native properties, the inherent property rights in the system, but not everyone's going to want that, right? Like the pension fund doesn't actually need to be self-sovereign and hold their own keys. Like that's not something that's desired. They want someone else to do that. They want Coinbase custody, right? That's working with BlackRock to handle all that. And so I think that's fine. And that honestly like fits my mental model for how Bitcoin was going to monetize. I know a lot of people don't like this. A lot of people think it's the best thing in the world. I'm in the middle. I'm kind of agnostic. I'm saying, look, Bitcoin's permissionless. These guys are always going to come. That's how, kind of how I view it.
Yeah. And that's a great way to put it. And I agree with you. I think, you know, after seeing the returns on Bitcoin, you know, what was the meme going on? It was like green, green, red, you know, seeing all that and then probably getting their ass whooped on the returns every single year. It's like, all right, well, finally it's them. I don't know if it's necessarily them bending the knee or whatnot, but it's them recognizing that, hey, like, you know, obviously two things, like you said, their clients wanted it and, you know, their returns are there. And if the demand is there, they're all in the fee structure. But we talked a little bit about this earlier about the halving event. And I kind of want to dive into that about, you know, is it a supply shock or not? Because at this point, you know, we have 91 or maybe 92% of total Bitcoin in circulation by the time the halving hits. So, you know, that 8 or 9%, do you think that is going to, I guess, play a role in maybe not long-term or maybe not, I guess, like the overall supply, like, you know, coming out and coming through the flows now. But, you know, it's always been the narrative that this is kind of the reason why, you know, I guess Bitcoin kind of shoots up every 4 years. And in my eyes, it's more, I guess, correlated to the macro and the business cycle side of things. Do you think that the halving is still going to continue to matter, I guess, maybe this one, but maybe not the next one, you know, or are you like a believer in the super cycle theory? Like, how do you see the halving kind of playing out in this entire, you know, cycle that we have of Bitcoin?
Yeah, the halvings obviously are in effect. It, you know, at the margin, the daily flows matter, of course. But when I look at like the coins washing around, changing hands, I think at this juncture, it's more of paradoxically, it's more of a demand shock than a supply shock. And wait, why would it be demand shock? And I think it's because of this global marketing that the halving, right? TikTok next block, Bitcoin doesn't care. It's a few lines of code in the software that, you know, okay, block 840,000 comes, boom, instead of 6.25 Bitcoin, it's 3.125 Bitcoin issued per block. But it's much more like, wait, what? And people look at the chart, they look at the log chart, and they're like, holy crap, every time this halving thing comes. And I think, you know, this is the interesting thing, is that if you line it up, you know, you say you have, you talk about the macro in your other show often, in the show, of course. But when you look up Bitcoin's price and, you know, the PMI, Purchasing Managers Index, which is, you know, just kind of a measure of whether the economy is expanding or contracting, right? Above 50, manufacturing sector is increasing month over, or is growing month over month. Below 50, it's decreasing or contracting month over month. It's kind of a rate of change. You can see these liquidity cycles, right? And you can also, can I screen share here, or can I share any links or anything?
Yeah, free.
Or maybe I'll shoot you a link. I don't have it up right now, but maybe I'll pass it to you and then I'll pull this up. But it's a chart of the year-over-year global money supply. And so like M2, it's not a perfect measure, right? Of course, I know that. You know, there's bank reserves and all this stuff. But if you look at global M2 in dollar terms, right? So you add up like all of the developed, you know, nations, US, Europe, Japan, China, it's not a perfect measure, right? And a lot of this, you know, a lot of the money supply is very much opaque and kind of, you know, like it's Bitcoin's very trivial to quantify. I can, you know, in 2 seconds write a command, my Bitcoin node pull it up. It's different for like, you know, fiat currencies, but you know, these measures are the best we got. And so if we look at the M2 money supply, the year-over-year change, the Bitcoin year-over-year change in price, and the strength of the dollar in year-over-year terms, whether the dollar is increasing or decreasing, you see a very, very, very clear pattern. And so I'm going to pull this up for you. And I think I'll just share a link to my TradingView chart for you. And this chart is just, I view it as like, you know, it's undeniable that, okay, yeah, the halving may play a part. Of course, I'm not saying it doesn't. But this is like, I think, not the secret sauce, but like this is like the chart of truth for Bitcoin, I would say. And it's a check on the system. So should I put this in the private chat?
Is that what? Yeah, you can do that. Or you can, there's a little button on the bottom that says present. So it's either up to you. I could do it right here.
Yeah, that'd be great. So just for the people that are watching this and maybe not listening. But yeah, like this is, I think this is much, especially now, right, is much greater effect than the halving, right? So, you know, there's the strength of the dollar in blue, global M2 year over year, and Bitcoin's drawdown, right? So, and you can see in the periods where the dollar is the strongest year over year, usually money supply, global M2 is contracting, right? And Bitcoin is drawing down, right? So here's the thing, right? Is currency and sovereign debt in this weird way are fungible. So if Japan prints a bunch of yen, right, the money supply globally is increasing, but the dollar, so the money supply is increasing, the dollar is also strengthening against the yen, right? So there's this kind of this weird push and pull where central banks and global, these sovereigns kind of almost like competitively debase. This was the game for the longest time. And we saw a little bit of a shift in, you know, the post-COVID world. But I still think this is the game, right? Is sovereigns, you know, the currency issuers, we need credit expansion forever in this fiat system. It's a fact. You can't change that fundamental reality. And so Bitcoin, you know, people like say this is like it's a bad thing. They're like, Bitcoin is the only way Bitcoin succeeds is if the dollar, you know, goes to zero or hyperinflates or whatever. And it's like the dollar is doing what it is doing. Besides Bitcoin, completely irrelevant to Bitcoin. Bitcoin's just this system existing block after block that's traded, right? It's never mind what Bitcoin's doing. But I think there's this increasing recognition from the Bitcoiners, but also just the investor class, particularly after these ETF approvals where they have access to the vehicle, where they say, wait a second, you know, the Fed's doing what? Or wait a second, they're issuing how much debt? And it's this almost like this check on the system, you know, for the longest time, like Greg Foss, you know, talks about like, you know, credit default swaps. And I think like that sort of thing goes way over a lot of people's heads. But that's what Bitcoin is, right? It's a check on the system. And it's not to say Bitcoin succeeds, you know, only if hyperinflation happens? No, right? But in a world where the national debt's increasing like at a 7 to 8 to 9% compound annual growth rate forever, right? In a world where we have hundreds of trillions of dollars of unfunded liabilities, where we're in this debt spiral, there's value in something that can't be debased and something that you can own with your own property rights, that you can hold in your head, that has a, you know, a tangible marginal production cost that continues to increase. And so it's, you know, a lot of people haven't done the work, but more so than ever, I think with this macro landscape, but also where Bitcoin is at, you know, $800-900 billion, it's more so a macro asset than it's ever been. That's undeniable. And so thus, I would say it's more about the liquidity flows than it's ever been before. So the halving, of course, it's this kind of like this annual reminder, this, you know, quadrennial every 4 years reminder that, hey, you know, you can't change the system. And also it's like this reinforcement of the absolute scarcity. So I think the halving matters, but it's less so like, oh, you know, the miners have, you know, 450 less coins to sell a day, which I don't really think is irrelevant, right? You're looking at these ETF flows. You're looking at, you know, like last cycle, right? Grayscale and MicroStrategy bought like 400,000 Bitcoin in a year, which was like the entire amount of the new coins issued, right? And a lot of those miners didn't even sell those coins. So it's much more about, in my opinion, the flows than it is the, you know, marginal tweak or reduction of the supply. And so every halving, right, it matters relatively less. And I think, and I kind of feel the same about this one, but it's obviously very much bullish because it's this reminder to everyone that doesn't understand this, that, you know, there's this alternate system out there.
Yeah, that's a great point. And I think, you know, it's also another talking point too, at the very least, right? I mean, it's just like the programmable aspect of Bitcoin. You can't change the supply, those kind of things. You know, I think that just kind of gets reiterated and it's, you know, a talking point for like the general media as well. And I think, you know, over time, just orange pilling people, the more touch points they get, the more likely they're going to be orange pilled in my eyes. Like, you know, if they just heard about Bitcoin for the first time, I think it's very unlikely to orange pill somebody, at least in the United States. Whereas, you know, maybe after like the sixth or seventh time, they'll finally listen. But, you know, you had a tweet thread too about acceleration, right? Which I kind of want to get into because, you know, the guys that kind of started this were all in Canada. So shout out to them. I met them at the Canadian Bitcoin conference. But anyway, they're the accelerationist is what they kind of call themselves. And a big part of what they say is, you know, I guess the way that they described it to me is, you know, Batman and the Joker both are in Gotham, right? Batman is trying to save the city of Gotham by, you know, essentially just, you know, trying to fight everybody, going through the shadows, like lurking, fighting everybody. Where the Joker could kind of be looked at as doing the same thing, but he's just trying to burn it down so they could rebuild it. So the accelerationists almost look at themselves as similar to the Joker aspect of things, where, you know, dive in, lean into, you know, all the craziness and clown world and that kind of aspect of things, which would in turn kind of, you know, as you were saying, you know, make the dollar stronger or, you know, lean us into the fiat system a little bit more until it in turn collapse. But the way that you're kind of describing it is that, you know, I guess, correct me if I'm wrong, is that the current dollar system has really no effect of what Bitcoin is going to do long term. So am I kind of getting that correct? And I know you had a nice long tweet, I guess it's not a thread anymore, about the acceleration aspect of it. So if you want to dive into that too, feel free.
Yeah, of course. And my camera's focus is a bit weird. Try to fix that. But regardless, yeah, one sec. Let me fix my camera.
No worries.
I don't know what's going on. It'll refocus. But the accelerationism, you know, I think there's a couple of people that, you know, talked about or, you know, championed the idea of Bitcoin accelerationism before me. You know, there's this movement in Silicon Valley of effective accelerationism, which was a direct response to the effective altruism, which was, you know, famously championed by Sam Bankman-Fried, right? And it was this idea that, look, AI and tech is accelerating at a breakneck pace, and we need to really put safeguards in place at a government level, at a regulatory level, to protect everybody. And this, by extension, this mindset doesn't just apply to compute. It also applies to energy. It also applies to basically every part of our life, right? We need these safeguards. We need these rails. You can't be doing those wonky things with your computer. We need you to be under our umbrella. And the effective accelerationists were saying, like, look, no. The problem to all these solutions you're talking about, whether it's climate change or whether it's, like any of these socioeconomic issues or political issues, is technology. It's the fact that energy as we know it is energy consumption or production, one and the same, is actually a derivative of human productivity. It's a derivative of our standard of living, right? If you think about like the Industrial Revolution, like is the standard of living better for humans on average or worse after the internal combustion engine and after, the invention of modern medicine and after, antibiotics, right? Like all of these things, if you think about it at a deep physical level, all of these things are using energy, right? They're increasing entropy in the world. When entropy, I mean like at the most basic, like physics level. A lot of these effective accelerationists are talking, they're rooted in what they would call like first principles and thermodynamic terms, right? And so for me, I looked at this movement of tech guys that were saying, look, we are not bowing down to government control. We're actually going to blaze ahead. We're going to continue pushing at a breakneck pace. We're going to continue developing. We're going to continue to push this idea that information is our right, and it's not given to us by government. And all we're doing is transmitting information, and we're going to lean in. And I looked at that and I saw, I think Bitcoin, and I think to like a lot of, the theses of like someone like a Jeff Booth, who is saying for years now, like, look, we have two fundamental truths that are incompatible with each other. We have the truth that technology, and particularly like everything with artificial intelligence, is continuing to develop at a breakneck pace. Moore's law essentially is, semiconductor efficiency or productivity doubling every 2 years. The amount of transistors on a semiconductor is doubling every 2 years. So it's going exponential, right? If you think about just like what you can do, like the iPhone is, more developed than the most advanced supercomputer in all of the world, X years ago, right? And there's a billion of them out there. And so this trend is actually not stopping and is continuing on. And us humans can't comprehend like the exponential function. So we have this reality where artificial intelligence and technology continues to develop, not at a linear pace, at an exponential pace. So what the second and third order effects of that are massive. And then at the same time, which in theory, right, in theory and in practice, you have that system, while it reduces jobs, right? For instance, the telemarketer, right, is going to be, and if not already, replaced by a robot, some code, right? In the same way, the horse and buggy is also obsoleted by the internal combustion engine, or, whatever your analogy is. That sort of thing is actually not bad because it reduces our jobs. It's a good thing, right? Instead of like 10 million, Algebra 1 teachers, there's a YouTube series on MIT or Khan Academy that can teach you from the best teacher in the world, and it's free, right? So that's happening, and a lot of people are in denial of that. And at the same time, with all of this tech and all of this advancement of technology, we have this reality of the monetary system that requires perpetual expansion of credit and circulation of the money supply. So where all of this should be, when productivity increases in an economic system, you should see prices go down in a world where you have a fixed amount of units in the system. But because of this, we don't have that, and we have an exponentially expanding money system to combat this. So we have this force that's being combated by the money supply increase. So when you look at the delta or the rate of change of a lot of prices in the system, anything touched by technology is actually either flat or have gone down, right? So I can buy a plasma 72-inch TV for a couple hundred bucks, right? Where that's actually cheaper than a piece of garbage, you know, static TV that was, you know, 150 pounds 20 years ago, right? And it's cheaper now, right? Or just, you know, think of like all of the functions in my phone, calculator, you know, camera, search engine, like all these things. What would that have cost someone 30 years ago? And there's like actually no price tag possible that you could have put on it. And I can buy this for a couple hundred bucks and, you know, $20 a month phone plan. So that reality up against this perpetually expanding money system doesn't work. And what it leads to is a growing amount of wealth inequality and economic distortion that is only fixable in the political climate by issuing more currency, right? The masses rise up saying, you know, this is not fair, right? I work all day, every day, and I'm treading, and I can't, and these rich billionaires and these rich, you know, innovators, right, are actually the problem, right? Jeff Bezos is evil, when in reality, these people that are saying that, or, you know, order Amazon 7 days a week to the front door, delivered in a day, right? So, and not to get into like the whole class system, but these two truths are battling up against each other. And so I think the Bitcoin accelerationist thesis is, look, when you think about a world that is using ever more energy, right? And what we're doing as a civilization is climbing Kardashev scale. Kardashev was this Russian theorist that said, look, the civilization can be measured or quantified by how advanced it is, by how much energy it uses. And a type one civilization, this is entirely theoretical, but a type one civilization harnesses all of its planet's available energy. A type two civilization uses all of its solar system's energy. And a type three is the whole galaxy, right? This is obviously theoretical, but the entire point is that energy consumption isn't bad, it's good. We should lean in. It's that tech isn't bad, it's good, we should lean in. But none of this can be realized when the communication mechanism of the system is broken. And the communication mechanism of a civilization is the monetary medium. So Bitcoin as an absolute fixed supply, proof of work network with a marginal production cost that's forever going higher, is this the crux of this effective accelerationist thesis that, you know, many people in the West Coast, Silicon Valley types haven't figured out, right? They're very much like Web3 crypto aligned. And so for me, I think there's this, you know, mass horde of really, really smart, wealthy, you know, tech investors and just people, individuals that are, you know, increasingly realizing, you know, what the end game of all of this tech development is, but they haven't put the final piece of the puzzle together. That is that we need an immutable fixed monetary medium to make this all work. So I think that's, you know, kind of a long-winded answer to what this thesis is. It's obviously a kind of a whomper of a of a thesis, but I don't think many people have put the two together. So I'm excited to kind of do my part in communicating it. And I, you know, still need to do a better job at it. But yeah, that's the basis of it.
I think you do a great job. So don't give yourself too hard of a time. But, you know, with all that being said, I guess, what do you think is next or missing or kind of like holding everybody back? Is it more of like an education aspect of things? Is it more of improving, you know, medium of exchange, the Lightning Network, kind of the robustity of that? Like, what do you think is the next step in order to kind of continue that, I guess, the path of more adoption and development?
Yeah, I think it's all the above. You know, we're going to pour, there's going to be tens, hundreds of billions of dollars poured into the asset itself. The development and proliferation of second layers is obviously very much important. There is the reality that we can't scale on-chain usage to 7 billion people. So, you know, optimizing the efficiency and the economic density of every on-chain transaction is of utmost importance. This is why I actually, you know, the whole spam debate and all that, I think, is missing the entire point, which is, you know, for 2022 and for, you know, for many periods in Bitcoin prior, you could basically get into a block for no cost. And my thesis for the longest time has been that, you know, Bitcoin is this monetary commodity that has immense value. You know, it's going to be worth trillions, tens of trillions, hundreds of trillions eventually. And, you know, it's going to be the most valuable commodity in the world. And, among the next most valuable commodity, or maybe not the next most valuable, but with that, if that thesis is true, then the block space is going to be an extremely valuable commodity itself. Because if you have this immutable settlement network, or that, you know, this immutable, this absolutely scarce asset on immutable rails, the immutable rails, you know, by definition, if, you know, when the block subsidy is going to zero, this is going to be extremely costly in a good way to settle on, right? Brandon, if I wanted to buy a t-shirt from you in 2045, I'm not going to send you an on-chain transaction. One, because, you know, it's just not going to be economic, you know? And so that's why with, you know, fees at $10 or whatever it is, like, and it's a fool's errand to say, oh, fees are going to be X dollars or X satoshis in X years. It's just, that is pointless. But with the realization that you can do all of this stuff with arbitrary data, like, never mind the JPEGs or, you know, the stupid tokens that people are putting in JSON blobs in the network. I think the realization from the crypto people that, whoa, this Bitcoin thing, it's the only immutable blockchain. It's the most costly blockchain. And that's not bad. That's actually good, right? For the longest time, it was like, Bitcoin's too slow. It's too costly. We're going to create XYZ chain with, you know, ABC token. And now I think a lot of these crypto people are saying, like, wait a second. I don't want to be building on Ethereum, or I don't want to be building on this, that, or the other thing. We're going to do it right on Bitcoin, because it's the best. I think it not should be encouraged, but we should lean in, right? It's like, yes, Bitcoin is actually the most valuable chain. And yes, all economic settlement is going to want to be on Bitcoin. And so there's this realization that, okay, whoa, you know, a lot of the scaling that we've been talking about, we still have a long way to go, right? And the scaling is going to come in the form of many things: centralized custodians, i.e. Coinbase holding Bitcoin for custody for BlackRock, who has an ETF. And it's also going to be in the form of, you know, federated sidechains like a Liquid. It's going to be in the form of, you know, layer two solutions like Lightning. But, like, I think people should realize, and this is very much an objective opinion, but, like, the scaling in a decentralized way still needs a lot of work, right? Like, I'm a hardcore Bitcoiner. I spend 10 hours a day thinking about this, playing with it, talking with people in the, you know, forums and all this. Setting up a Lightning node that's efficient is tough, right? And obviously it's, you know, if you want to use Lightning with River, right, it's great. It's an amazing user experience. Alex Leishman and the team has done a fantastic job. Or, you know, with any other of these centralized solutions, Lightning is, boom, great. Scan a QR code, send $500 for half a penny, and it settles instantly. And you're like, whoa, this is powerful. But if we're talking about a world that this is all done without actually giving up any ownership, you know, and where you have complete sovereignty and autonomy, there still needs to be a ton of work done. And so the fact that we're, you know, that fees are rising earlier, you know, than many people expected is not a bad thing. It's a great thing. Because the whole idea, at least in my opinion, is like, we need to scale this puppy to 7 billion people. And so if this thesis is upended by 10,000 crypto degenerate traders spamming the chain, then, like, oh boy, we need to work on this thing and figure out how we're going to onboard 100 million people. Because, you know, that's where I'm thinking of this all. So, yeah, I think, like, what happens next? Well, you know, a ton of capital is going to flow in. I think a lot of the crypto people are reevaluating their thesis. And a bunch of people are short Bitcoin, not short, like, financially, like, shorting the asset. But, you know, a lot of people, both, you know, when I'm talking about the accelerationist crowd, a lot of those people are very much, like, aligned with the Coinbase sort of, like, Web3 theses of, like, you know, blockchain for everything. And we're going to have, like, XYZ token for this and that. And, you know, there's still very much going to be an attempt to do all that. But I personally believe, like, all of this is trending to one. all of this monetary premium is trending to one asset, one currency, one money, Bitcoin. And all of the rails are going to be, you know, Bitcoin adjacent, right? Bitcoin centric. Like, so when I see, and again, the NFT sort of thing, like my opinion in 2021, NFT JPEG monkeys are stupid, right? Great. That's my opinion. And you know, me posting on Twitter about ETH NFTs means nothing, right? When those people come onto Bitcoin and submit a valid Bitcoin transaction and speculate on a monkey JPEG, right? But which, by the way, the actual technical infrastructure is much more robust than it was on ETH. You know, whereas an ordinal is just a blob of data that's immutable on Bitcoin. Whereas, you know, the ETH, it's a hyperlink to a URL that can be rubbed. But never mind all that. When I see a marketplace that's pricing in Bitcoin, that's settling in Bitcoin, right? Pricing in Bitcoin, like 0.01 BTC for X or whatever it is, settling on Bitcoin rails, I think that's cool, right? So never mind, like, you know, whether, and even if I didn't think it was cool, I couldn't stop it. So I think all of this is very much positive. I think that, you know, because ultimately, like, I believe, and I don't know about you or many of the other Bitcoiners, but like the store of value thesis is, you know, the first meal. We're talking medium of exchange and unit of account too, right? Like if you think Bitcoin wins and you think you're, you know, you're sufficiently bullish on Bitcoin, then you're 50 years from now, we're denominating a house in Satoshis, right? Like that's the ultimate bull case. So if people want to trade whatever they want and they're denominating in Bitcoin and paying in Bitcoin, and I can't stop it even if I wanted to, like that's where for me, like I very much am bullish, and I'm not bullish because of ordinals or not. I'm just the thesis was always for me that all these crypto people are coming back to Bitcoin. It's all these tech people are coming to Bitcoin, and all these Wall Street people are coming to Bitcoin. And you know, at the margin, it looks like that's all happening. So I think more of the same is what's needed. You know, I personally think the genie's out of the bottle, and so I'm just excited to see where it all goes.
Yeah, that's interesting. And that's kind of the, I guess, the first time I've heard it worded that way, because it seems like everybody kind of has, you know, ordinals are good because, you know, it brings in, you know, the crypto people or whatnot. But, you know, everybody seems to be, I guess, of the consensus that the high fees are not good in the short term. But, you know, what you're describing as in the long term, you know, it makes a lot of sense, right? I mean, in order to scale, we need to figure out how to combat this problem. We'd rather be having this problem here in 2024 than in 2045, when we have, you know, theoretically, you know, millions and millions of more people onboarded using this, you know, as a medium of exchange on a daily basis. So, you know, you're convincing me the other way, I think.
Well, like, here's the thing, Brandon, I think good or bad, what you have to ask is, can you stop it? And increasingly, I think that people are realizing, right, you can't. So, right, like data, it's very trivial to put arbitrary data in the blockchain, right? There's the witness, the witness discount with SegWit, where, you know, a lot of this inscription stuff is happening. But, you know, Satoshi put, you know, Chancellor on the brink of bailouts in the block header, right? You know, Luke Dasher Jr., or it was the block header or operaturn, I should know this. There's the operaturn data that you can put in. You can put data in a public key. You can put data in an address where I can say, you know, it's BC1 Dylan, you know, XYZ 123, whatever, right? I can write data in the address, right? So there's infinite ways to put arbitrary data on the chain. So if you want to play this, like the filter proponents are saying, like, well, we need to stop this or stop this. And even Luke Dasher Jr. is like, look, we need to, I think operaturn data is spam. And people are like, what? But the entire point is, like, if you want on your node, Brandon, to say, look, I'm going to filter this out and I'm not going to recognize this as a transaction, sure. But people are going to relay around you. And unless you want to shatter consensus and fork, then you can't actually stop it. So there's no point, right, in like I can cry and moan and scream on Twitter and I can call people scammers. And honestly, that's your right to. Like, if you say that someone's a scammer, fine, you know, like that's okay. But you can't stop it, right? It's the same way that, like, I don't agree with many things in the world, But if my thesis is Bitcoin is permissionless money, like I don't agree with, you know, selling drugs, right? Or like, but people are going to sell drugs with Bitcoin because Bitcoin's permissionless money. And so like that doesn't break my brain. It doesn't break my worldview. And so good or bad, they're operating within consensus, and we can't stop it. So what are we going to do other than scale Bitcoin, you know, manage your UTXOs more efficiently and effectively and build second and third layers, right? Because I think everyone's base case should be like on-chain fees are going to $1,000 faster than you believe, right? And if that, you know, confronts your mental model on how Bitcoin scales, on how we onboard users, well, that's a good thing because this is where we're headed anyway, right? So like this is accelerating these talks on the second layers. This is accelerating a lot of the things that we thought we were going to kick the can down for 10 more years. Like, look, you know, the block reward is still very much going to be sufficient for 10 years. Great. Well, you know, now we're in a world where sometimes fees, you know, not often, but fees for many blocks in 2023, not many, but like, I don't know, a day or two's worth, were higher than the block subsidy, right? Like, whoa, where did that come from? And with the next halving, it's going to even be more so. And so also like too, if you think that these things aren't good or a spam, how do you convince the miners to turn away revenue, right? Like, because my model has always been Bitcoin works because of economic incentives, not altruism, right? This entire thing is economic incentives. So if you expect a miner to say, whoa, look, sorry, I don't like your graffiti. I'm going to not be incentivized by economics and I'm going to be incentivized by altruism. Well, I disagree with your model on how this whole system operates. The system is greed. And if I'm a miner, I'm not saying this transaction is good or bad. I'm saying this transaction pays me more, right? So like, why is Bitcoin censorship resistant, Brandon? It's censorship resistant because you can always bribe the miners to include your block, to include your transaction. So like that's, and I look pretty deeply into how Bitcoin's censorship resistant. Censorship resistant because you always can bribe the user, bribe the miners, right? It's not like there is no security budget. There is only your security budget, which is you bribing miners. So like that's where I think a lot of the debate gets a little bit lost. But like certainly the conversation is very much interesting. And the bifurcation of like camps or whatever sides, of which like I don't even find myself on a side. Like people on both sides are like, you idiot, and I'm like, what? Like, you know?
No, I mean, I get it 100%. I mean, it's like, you know, what is it like? Once you have an opinion, they try to pencil you into or push you into a corner, and it has to be one side or the other. But you know, if you float in the middle, everybody hates you at a certain point in time. Yeah. But you know, before I let you go, I want to ask one last macro question. Obviously, we alluded to it a little bit at the beginning of the show, the interest rate environment. Jerome Powell has kind of, I guess, described that they've talked about when they're going to cut in 2024. It's been the higher for longer mantra throughout this time. So I'll put you on the spot here. I know you don't like the short term predictions, but what do you think about the predictions for Jerome Powell, kind of what he's doing? The market's been screaming for a pivot for over a year now. So it seems to be on the docket. But, you know, I guess how do you see this playing out? Does it lead to, you know, I guess another version of the Great Depression, or do you think they're going to kind of print our way out of it to keep this fiat Ponzi, keep going for, I guess, at least another cycle?
No, yeah, I mean, they're going to keep the Ponzi going. I was of the opinion in 2023, particularly like earlier in 23, just given how bonds traded. I mean, we had never seen a bond drawdown like that, that things were going to get very much ugly. And they did for a little bit there. You know, there was the kind of the discrete bailout with the Bank Term Funding Program, BTFP, which, you know, essentially the bond that was started at $100 that was trading at $60, you know, these banks could go to the Fed and they would be valued as collateral at 100, right? So it's like this discrete bailout, you know, obfuscated by all this financial jargon that the Main Street doesn't really know about. And that's been used to only, you know, 100 billion or so, right? Only 100 billion, which is crazy. But you know, I think that the economic prospects are actually you know, pretty bullish. There's been a, you know, a decent disinflation, and obviously, you know, the warped incentives and reality of our system is the actual consumer price index has never been higher, but the rate of change has decreased. You know, the derivative, there's been a, you know, a deceleration in the rate of inflation. So that's, you know, good for financial assets. And so, yeah, there's a bunch of rate cuts penciled in. I wouldn't be surprised if a couple are walked back, but I think, you know, just based on the fiscal situation, which is independent of the Fed, right, where they're just, you know, spending money out the wazoo, and the U.S. Treasury market being the most liquid market in the world, when they're, you know, issuing all this money, they've drained, you know, their reverse repo from a trillion or so to whatever it is today, or a couple trillion to, you know, they drained like a trillion and a half. So that's been a decent buffer. So could there be some wonkiness? Could there be, you know, a fake out, you know, some pivot, whatever, like, sure. But I think the reality is that we're in uncharted territory in terms of the debt loads and the debt burdens. And so there can be no real long-term austerity. So like, you know, even a couple months or whatever, it's like, look, they have to, there is no actual feasible possibility of medium, not even long-term, medium-term austerity, because of just how engorged we are with that. So, yeah, I mean, like, do I have a short intermediate term view on stocks or bonds here? Like, no. You know, in 2021, I was like screaming. I'm like, the 30 years at 1.5%, this is madness. Like, bonds are the biggest bubble the world has quite literally ever seen. We have $20 trillion of nominal negative yielding debt. Like, this should break your brain. The financial system is upside down. Am I buying 30-year debt at 4% now? No. But like, you know, for the people that got it at 5, it was quite a good trade. But like, even at 5%, am I interested in locking in, you know, like lending money to the government for 30 years? Like, of course not. Heck no. So I think that there's still, with debt to GDP at 120% plus, we're still due for a long period of sustained financial repression, because that's the only way out. You know, you see defaults with this level of debt, like, period, flat out, full stop, defaults occur. The only question, and it's not a question in my mind, is it an explicit default or an implicit default? And countries don't explicitly default on debt when they have a money printer. So it's an implicit default. You know, we've seen a decent inflation spike, but I'm, you know, if you had to ask me over the next 10 years, I would very confidently, you know, say or put my money where my mouth is, and I am with Bitcoin, that interest rates on average over the next 10 years are lower than the inflation rate, right? What does that look like? What's the average rate? I have no idea. But I would very much confidently say, as a betting man, you know, as someone in markets, that, you know, debt, credit, is going to, erode your purchasing power in real terms. So that's the story. And it's the biggest story that every investor in the world has to confront. And most people don't have an answer. They are kind of in this magical world, you know, for 40 years where the bonds gave you a positive real return. And we saw this brief sort of, you know, deviation in 2022 and 2023. And I think people are now like, okay, we're back, right? We're back to the good old days. And I disagree.
All right, man. Thank you so much for your time today. And why don't you let everybody know where they can find you, obviously on Twitter, but anywhere else and all the other stuff you got going on.
Yeah, of course. Appreciate you having me on, Brandon. It was a great hour that went by pretty fast. You can just find me on Twitter. I'm working on some stuff behind the scenes, but TBD on that. We'll, you know, have some public announcements when they come. But, you know, until then, find me at @DylanClaire_ on Twitter. And, you know, all things Bitcoin and, you know, everything else we discussed today. It was a fun chat.
Awesome stuff. Yeah, man. Thanks so much.